Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, delighted to welcome you to another edition of our program. And tonight, a really interesting and insightful story by Burley Vang, Polaroids of Tom. Here is Burley to read it for us.
Polaroids of Tom. I have a brother who would be 20 by now, had he lived beyond the 7 days in an incubator at Fresno Community Hospital, his name now lost to dirt and weeds. A chubby boy, my father described him, Papacholi, with bright red lips, my mother added, as if a rose petal landed under his nose. You and Abel were too young to visit him, they said. This was after I had discovered the photos. I was 3 and Abel was 1 when my mother went into labor for the 3rd time. We slept in the living room with my grandmother, who had pulled the sheets and blankets from the bedrooms and laid them on the carpet between the couches. It was a 2-bedroom apartment in a complex where most of the tenants like us were Hmong. I remember my father returning from the hospital to the house one night, the door opening with a rush of cold air, the jangle of keys in the living room. He crept lightly by our heads to avoid questions in the dark like, "Papa, when will Mama and the baby come home? Are they okay?" I learned how to speak in Hmong before the age of 1. My grandmother would boast about how clean my speech was to relatives whose children had not learned how to speak yet. But on the night when my father came home, I remained silent beneath the blankets, my habit of pretending to be fast asleep. This part of my memory is unclear, but I have always pictured him going into the bedroom and closing the door behind him. After a while, he'd come out into the living room and stand in the dark, perhaps watching us, listening to our breathing. He returned to my mother at the hospital as quiet as he had come, the cold air rushing in again as the door closed behind him. It was the sound of his car engine that stirred the neighborhood dogs. That I remember clearly. I was always afraid to hear the dogs. If a dog barks at night and no one is around, it means there is a da nearby, my grandmother would say, which is the Hmong word for a ghost, monster, or any spiritual entity that, in most cases, will cause a person to become ill or even die. The dogs kept barking long after my father had left the house. Was there someone or something sitting outside the door? I must have slipped back into sleep by cupping my ears under the moonlight flooding through the window curtains and wondering when my father would bring my mother home again with a new baby cradled in her arms. Abel and I had not seen her since the day she went into labor. I would cry in the late afternoon by the window screen, watching the other tenants come and go, their children playing in the grass. Sometimes the children would break from a game of tag or let their jump ropes loosen like snapping snakes suddenly gone flaccid and gather by our window to make crying faces. I would cry harder, and my grandmother would rush to the window to shoo them away like pigeons with their knuckles raised and gleaming. "If only your mothers were in the hospital too," I must have thought, as I wiped my eyes with my wrists and my nose on the curtain. Once the kids had fled, my grandmother would say, "Your mother will not come home because you are scaring her away with your crying," and run her fingers gently through my hair. When my mother was released from the hospital, she came home a tired woman, so tired and helpless that she did not look like my mother, not the one with the stern voice behind a smile, who always made sure Abel and I did not go hungry by feeding us rolled up balls of rice and meat with her fingers, and then scorning us if we did not finish our food. "Eat," she said. "Hmong kids in Laos swallow faster than the two of you." This pale woman was not my mother, her eyes wet and her hair in a mess. She struggled through the door, draped in my father's arms, her breath slow like a kettle cooling down as she was laid on the couch. Moonlight was her skin. Moonlight was her lips. Her body a leaf on the sidewalk. I kept distant until her arms reached for me. My father didn't speak much. I don't remember if I even asked why the baby was not with them. My mother underwent a cesarean section in order to give birth, but they did not thread the flaps of her flesh together after the operation. They stapled her shut instead, I remember the metal gleaming like teeth, her belly smiling with pain. "Don't jump on the couch," my father said. "She's very tired and hurt. Let her rest." I have imagined how the doctors must have pried her open with their mechanical tools, the womb gaping like lips of a flower in bloom, and lifted my brother out, lungs crying for air, eyes pooled with my mother's blood. There are two Polaroid photos, the only pictures I have of my third brother. There are no dates, no names. I discovered them while searching for my kindergarten class photo in a dresser my parents used to keep family albums and folders containing bank statements, tax papers, and birth certificates. The pictures were tucked inside the pocket of a yellow folder. I was 7 at the time. In the first photo, my brother is wearing a light blue beanie with his eyes closed and his fists tied in mittens, a frown framed between two rosy cheeks. In the other, the beanie is not worn, his lips parted by a slow yawn. His tongue is visible, gums pink, but the viewer's eyes, upon glancing, would immediately avert from obvious facial features to the sudden red egg jutting from the nest of his head, just above the eyebrows where the growth of skin and bone stopped. There is no scalp except for a film of tissue stretched over the naked brain where a skull cap should have grown. I was looking for my kindergarten class photo. I was 7. Who could forget the contrast between the raw of red and the yellow of infant skin? The blazing color of apples became a memory stain. Though there is nothing terrifying to me about the photo, not like the barking of a dog at night, it has haunted me in a way a recurring dream would run itself through my years of sleep during the quiet hours of REM. Recurring dreams I do not forget. The shade of apples has never left me. There were times when I take the photos from my parents' room into my bedroom and place them underneath my mattress. At night, I curled a whisper around his name, the letters spelled out in the dark like smoke. I even daydreamed about how infants were handled in hospitals after death. Were they laid into tiny coffins, little eyes and lips resting in shoeboxes? Throw away is a literal translation of the Hmong word used to describe the burial process. I believed my brother didn't have a funeral, since my parents never mentioned it, since I had no recollection of it. As I grew older, I assumed that all infants who died in hospitals were probably tossed away like broken thermometers, bloody latex gloves, or a doctor's half-eaten sandwich. Being so small and dead, they were probably not worth the time and space for a funeral and burial. Babies swam in my head, all kinds of dead babies. Pink skin, black skin, red skin, and yellow skin, all placed inside black garbage bags, ready to be dropped into blue hospital bins. Throw away. The words would light up in my head. Growing up, my family hardly spoke about the third son. What I imagined filled in the spaces of blank memories was a weight too much to be carried on our lips at dinner, out in an open conversation. I was the oldest child, and yet I could not bring myself to question my parents, especially my mother, whose eyes welled up like clouds, her tears heavy for the past when his name was mentioned at the table. My grandmother, who came to America an old woman, had told my mother to find a husband because no one would look after her if my grandmother were to suddenly die. At 14, my mother became a high school dropout and an immigrant housewife. "I needed security and your father was there to provide it," she said. I was not in love. When I was born, my father was an assistant manager at San Lorenzo's nursery company, a flower shop in Santa Ana, where he pushed 50 hours a week for an hourly wage of $5.75, which was above the starting minimum. "From the moment you spilled from your mother," he said to me, "all you did was cry. You did not stop crying. Even if we held you," my mother said, "we had to exchange turns throughout the night. You were always sick with fever." So they called up every shaman in Orange County, weekend after weekend, to figure out why I was crying and how to put an end to it. They even caught an old man who claimed to have superhuman powers, who could bite into red-hot iron bars without burning his teeth and tongue. I was possessed, everyone agreed, and the spirit haunting me had to be expelled through Wanang, a ritual in which a shaman must enter a trance and ride his magic horse into the underworld, where he would negotiate with the spirit responsible for his patient's sickness. Aside from a few family photographs and a framed painting of a ship sailing alongside an enormous sperm whale, the inside of our tiny apartment was covered with endless rows of spirit money. It looked like gold and silver leaves had grown out from the wall. During Wanang ceremonies, incense sticks were burned over bowls of rice and boiled chicken eggs. The sounds of a gong and a shaman's finger bells filled the air. So did the voices of neighbors and relatives who had gathered to watch the shaman at work. My crying prevailed in the midst of all this. "The spirit is your son's own spirit," many of the shamans said to my father. "He is not happy with the name you gave him." My father has told me that Burley is not a Hmong name. It came from nowhere. To this day, he does not know why or how he came up with it. So to find a new name, a shaman had to hoop li, which, in this case, was the act of throwing a pair of split bullhorns in front of the door and asking my spirit for forgiveness. Burley had been a terrible choice. My parents told me that my name was changed over 20 times, perhaps even 30, although they can no longer recall any of the new names they had given me then. However, they did remember both my arms covered in sleeves of white blessing strings, from wrist to armpit, which made me cry even harder. I must have hated all the new names because I was still sick. My spirit was not contented. The shamans had done everything. In the end, my father snipped off all the blessing strings with a pair of scissors, tore down the spirit money as if tearing down the walls themselves, and cursed the ancestors who couldn't help us. He threw everything they had to do with Wanang and Hoop Li into the aluminum tray in which my mother baked whole chickens in. "If you cannot help my son," he shouted to the ancestors, "then I will not depend on your stupid rituals anymore." He struck up a match and lit up the contents. The smoke rose into the wind outside our apartment, everything wrinkling in flames, and I got my name back. But I did not stop crying. He placed his hand on my temple, which was still hot with fever. After a moment of silent indecision, he picked up the phone and, with a little hope and mostly doubt, dialed the local Hmong church to come pray for us, to see if their God was worth more than ashes. After the hymns and prayers, I stopped crying. This was our conversion story that my parents would tell from time to time whenever a weary Hmong relative wandered into our home. "The ghost, my son's spirit, whatever it was, had left him in peace," my father would say with great pride. "It was as if God had pulled a tack out of his bottom," my mother joked. Although we became Christians, my grandmother remained a shamanist until the day she died. "She was not happy that we had abandoned the old traditions," my parents reminded the children. "She has held it against us ever since then." My parents were faithful Protestants, their lives renewed through the Christian Missionary Alliance, which held a network of Hmong churches in America. We did not dabble in the past anymore. We separated from all Wanang and Hoop Li practices. Not a single sheet of spirit money ever found its way into our home again. No incense sticks lighted over bowls of rice and boiled eggs. No shaman welcomed in to ride his magic steed once more, galloping over hushed meadows, mountains, and clouds filled with lost and wandering spirits. Because my parents had completely swept the old traditions out the door like bones from an old meal, we also stopped calling our dead to eat with us at the dinner table or to fill in the quiet spaces between our living bodies, to join us in laughter and in sadness. Those who begged in the afterlife would stand outside our home, palms raised like bows at our windows, our door completely closed to them and to those who would die later. I saw my third brother in a dream once. He was not a baby, but a small child walking by. Or perhaps he floated by me in a crowd of strange people. He whispered his name. That's how I knew it was him. I don't know if we talked. I forgot the look on his face, but I told my mother the next day. What she said, I have forgotten. There is a history of frequent encounters with sitting ghosts in my family, a type of da known to hold its human victims in a paralyzed state. These attacks occur during the moments before sleep enters the mind or at the point of waking from sleep. My brother Abel is the family member most familiar with these spiritual confrontations. His experiences range from waking to an old couple sitting on top of him, to hearing flies buzzing in his ears and smelling the stench of decay in our living room. 2 weeks after my grandmother died, he woke up in the middle of the night to find her slouched at his feet, her fingers wrapped around his ankle. She was weeping. He was unable to move until my mother heard his gasps for air and rushed to his side, slapping him twice in the face. I used to call it sleep paralysis, the term coined by researchers who have studied this phenomenon. It occurs in the gradient between waking and REM stage, when the body is paralyzed and disconnected from the brain, which is at a fully conscious state. No one can explain the exact causes behind it. Although it is not considered dangerous, scientific reports indicate that a great number of Hmong men have died from these so-called sitting ghost attacks, their faces often twisted in grimaces of terror. In my early experiences with sleep paralysis, unlike Abel, I did not have the notion that something or someone was sitting on top of me. My limbs were just paralyzed, a feeling similar to the difficulty of trying to clench a fist during the moments after waking from a drowsy summer nap. Flies didn't buzz in my ears, no stench of decay in my nostrils. My body was asleep while my eyes gazed around the room, running over the shapes of furniture until the connection between my mind and body was established. I caught a sleep paralysis, not a sitting ghost attack. That changed on a night in 2003. I was sleeping on a twin bed with my girlfriend. We had decided to share a room to lower the living costs of being away from home for college. I remember waking that night and noticing the moonlight in the room, the outlines of the dresser and the desk. As I tried to fall asleep again, I was startled by the sudden shift of weight on the bed. 2 small feet pressed into the mattress and hopped over my legs to the side of the wall under the window. It was a hot night and the curtains had been closed. It was 4-something a.m. on the alarm clock. A child was weeping at my feet. I was terrified. My limbs were still functional, so I turned my body toward my girlfriend, but in mid-turn, its small hand reached out and held my calf. The fingers squeezed. A strange numbness shot up from the spot of contact through my entire body, and I couldn't move, nor was I able to muster up a scream for help. This was not the usual sleep paralysis I had experienced in the past. My index finger was the only working limb, how valuable it had suddenly become, and I started poking my girlfriend's side with great effort to disturb her out of sleep, but she only pushed me away like an unwanted blanket. What should have been screams came out as whimpers from deep within my chest. For several minutes, the child held on, enveloping me in its numbness, becoming a part of me, the two of us in mid-turn under the moonlight. We were both weeping into each other's ears. After my parents moved from Orange County to Fresno and Abel was born, my father became unemployed. He was going to college at the time, so they applied for Medi-Cal. My mother went to a small clinic during the months before the arrival of her third son. She doesn't remember the name of the clinic, except that it was owned by a Thai couple whose patients were mostly Hmong refugees, speaking little or no English at all. The physician, who was the husband, had prescribed a bottle of pills for my mother to take for 2 consecutive months. She would keep a regular schedule for follow-ups. Sometimes she met the wife instead of the husband. My father always went with her. At the end of 2 months, she returned to the clinic with the empty bottle. It was the wife who met her this time in one of the examining rooms. "I have finished," my mother said, showing the bottle. The wife took it from my mother, and after raising it to her glasses so that she could read its label, her eyes widened. "You're not supposed to take this," she said. "Who told you to take this?" "Your husband," my mother said. "He gave it to me 2 months ago." "No, no, no. This is not good for you. This is the wrong medication." My mother remembers the shock on the wife's face and how the husband was called immediately into the room. The wife scolded him in Thai for his irresponsibility, why he did not catch himself giving his patient the wrong drug prescription. However, it all ended quickly with the husband's apology to my parents. The wife tried to maintain a smile to assure my mother that she would be fine. that the child in her womb would not be born without a skull cap? My mother did not sue them, nor did she display any outrage towards the couple's irresponsibility. Her body felt the same way it had felt during the first two experiences with childbearing. She did not notice any effects from the pills. It was her assumption that if the baby had been affected, her body would have felt different. She was having her third son, and that was all that occupied her mind. During my mother's first and second pregnancies, a machine was used by her previous doctors to allow her to listen to the child's heartbeats. In her third pregnancy, the Thai physician only used a stethoscope. My mother never had the chance to hear her son's heart, that dull ticking of life inside her. After she told me about the incident, I wanted to ask her why she didn't get a lawyer then, but I knew she would have answered, "I couldn't speak English well. Your father was busy with school. We were poor and did not know anyone." "What was the name of the pills he gave you?" I asked her instead. "I have forgotten," she said, nor could she remember the reasons why she had to take them. There was a funeral, my father said to me and Abel, during one of our dinners. The church helped with everything, money, food, and preparation. Since we had become Christians, our shamanist relatives refused to help. "How long did it last?" Abel asked. "A day and a night," my mother said. "I didn't go. I watched the two of you at home." "Your mother couldn't bear the thought of losing one of her sons," my father explained. "She also needed rest from the operation. Her cut did not heal yet." "Where was the funeral held?" I asked. "Fresno Funeral Chapel," my father said, "on A Street." "How come we didn't know about this?" Abel asked. "The two of you were too young then," he explained. "Then where was he buried?" I asked. "Your father knows. He can take the both of you there, now that you are old enough," my mother said. We looked at my father, his eyes gazing beyond us as if trying to trace the footsteps in his mind. "I have lost the way there," he finally muttered. "It's been such a long time. I have forgotten the roads. He was buried outside of Fresno, in a small cemetery. That is all I can remember." Outside the kitchen window, the sky was burning, the sun setting like a red yolk behind the roofs of telephone poles. At the dinner table, our conversation began, the silence broken by a funeral. Words fell from our lips as our spoons clinked against the china. My father sounded dry and solemn as he spoke. My mother stood at the sink and ran the water over our voices. "Not long ago, we bowed our heads and said an evening prayer together, our knees on the carpet beside my parents' bed. My father's voice was a torch leading us to the foot of God, where we thanked him for our daily bread and asked for the forgiveness of sins. 'Keep us together through the night,' was my father's last request. Like a swooping wing, my father gathered our names into the arms of God. But my heart was not in prayer then. I wondered if my third brother, whose name was not gathered, stood beyond those curtains, outside the window, wishing himself into my father's words. Years before, when I was 10, I sat with Abel on our parents' bed. We watched my parents trace the incision scar on my mother's belly, a constellation of staple prints beneath his index finger. They were on the bed whispering to one another. "After all these years, I still feel the pain if I do heavy work," she said to him. "It will probably never go away completely," he said. The cut was deep. We live in a four-bedroom house now, across the fields behind Fresno State University. My parents purchased it last year, since my return from college. I help with half of the monthly payment. The memories of living in a rundown apartment have become distant. Now and then, I imagine how children once played outside our window, chasing one another in the yellow grass as if it were a green meadow, or how jump ropes arced around the sun from the swing of a mongrel's hands. I beg these faces to cry for me once more. I can be three again. But we have lost both the Polaroid photographs, the only pictures we have of him. I must rely on memory now. My mother can't figure out where she placed the photos after the move. Which move? We have moved so many times. 5 apartments, 2 houses, boxes were thrown away. Should I look now in her luggage of family heirlooms, in the filing cabinet, a shoebox? If I dig into her belly, will I find them stuck to the wall of her cave? If I open up my father's skullcap, will I be able to trace the footsteps in the curved roads of his brain? The night my father came home from the hospital, did he close his bedroom door and kneel down to pray for my brother? Did he say his name at the bedside before coming out into the living room? Who were the dogs barking at? The road that leads to him is without footprints, washed long ago by the rain. It winds through the deep, hot countryside of my mind, past open fields lined with barbed fences, beyond Fresno. It curls beneath sycamores and around slabs of rock like an old lizard's tail. Where the road ends, overgrown weeds have taken over, yellowed by clay dirt. The gravestone among the weeds can be mistaken for a chipped boulder. Our prayers have not touched this place. Spirit money would burn in this heat. For 20 years, his ghost has called the crawling ants brothers, the crow and the bent oak father, and the moon when it is full mother. To them he calls with both hands raised like a bow, his orphan cry so shattering that the night could be glass. I can almost hear it by my bedside. What fragmented memories I have of his birth. I bury them here, next to his grave, on this side of my skull. I whisper his name, Tom, Tom, Tom. A drum beating these memories into the dirt, that they might bloom like roses, red as his crown, bleeding out of the earth.
That was Burley Vang reading a story of his entitled Polaroids of Tom. And most important of all is that the author, a first-generation Hmong, remembers a couple of shocking Polaroid photos of his baby brother Tom, who died about a week after he was born with, and now I'm quoting, a red egg jutting out from the rest of his head, just above the eyebrows where the growth of skin and bone stopped. And then we learned that his mother's doctor had given her some medicine which she had taken daily for several months. When she went back for a refill, the doctor's wife told her that it was the wrong medicine. So we're left to wonder if the medicine she had taken had arrested the baby's development and eventually did him in. And of course, because they were refugees, poor, with minimal English skills, they never got a lawyer, never sued, never found out who or what really killed the baby. We can only imagine that if the same incident had happened to a middle or upper class American family, the outcome might have been very much different. Friends, Burley Vang, our author tonight, has distinguished himself as a fine writer and poet. He earned a BA from UC Davis and an MA from Fresno State. He's been published by the Minnesota Literary Journal, Random House, and has been funded to write a memoir about his family. We've had him on before, but we're always enlightened by his descriptions and insights into the Hmong community. Thank you for your fine story tonight, Burley. We hope that you have more creative nonfiction pieces for us in years to come. And so we come to the close of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program again, just get online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, two authors, Catherine Johnstone and Ed Miller. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.